You're listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church, a relevant biblical community. For more information, visit houstonsfirst.org. Here's Pastor Greg Mott.
In college, I had a roommate. And my roommate in college, he was an architecture major, so he was kind of into the artsy side of things. And when he wasn't working on projects, he would actually do paintings and different things that he would like to do. And he would enter them in art shows, and they have an art display and all these different things. And so we had one of them that hung in our room. And I'm not, you know, I'm kind of a straightforward guy, so I don't always get the modern art type of deal. But he had this one that it hung on a wall, so I could understand that. It had a frame, so that helped me out. And so in this, it had this piece of kind of like tracing paper, and it had a dot-to-dot picture of a seashell. And this dot-to-dot picture of a seashell that was in this frame, and then it had push pins in it that would kind of hold it up into the frame. So it had this kind of contradiction of a frame where you'd put something very worthwhile and worthy, and then push pins where you would put something up very temporary. And so there's this combination against this, two things, and he actually gave me the picture. I liked it so much, and I hope that it's not worth a whole lot of money because I can't find it. I don't know where it is, so I lost it. So if it's worth a bunch of money now, I'm in trouble. So if he ever gets famous, I'm going to have to get him to make me another one. But we had this dot-to-dot picture of a seashell, and then it had this quote that went over the top of the seashell, and it was a quote that they asked this painter, "What's the meaning of your paintings?" And the painter responded with this quote, and this is what he said. "In the end, I realized that whatever meaning a painting has is the accumulated meaning of 10,000 brushstrokes, each one being decided as it was painted." So here was this dot-to-dot picture with this quote. What's the meaning of a painting? You can't give the whole meaning of a painting at once. The meaning of a painting is the combination of 10,000 brushstrokes. Each decision of brushstrokes, each dot to dot to dot to dot to dot makes the painting. That you can't say that this is the whole meaning, but here's a dot to dot. And each meaning was decided as you went from dot to dot, which each brushstrokes on the painting. And I've thought about that a lot of times because that's really a great description of life. What's the meaning of your life? Well, the meaning of your life is the culmination of all these different brushstrokes of where you grew up, experiences you had, good, bad, or in the middle of indifferent, all these different things that you've had, encounters of your life, education that you have. All these brushstrokes end up making this painting. All the dot-to-dots of your life end up making your life. And we're looking at the story of Joseph. And in the story of Joseph, we're getting to see the dot-to-dots of his life. Now, we know the end of the story, many of us, but if we can stop, and what we need to do with biblical narratives, when God is telling a story through the Bible, when you're seeing not just verse by verse telling you things to do or to teach you things, but a whole story, a biography of someone's life, a true story, we can look at it and we can see the dot to dot of what God's doing. We can see the brush strokes of what happens. And even though we know the end of the story of Joseph's life, we've got to be able to look at it and to see what is God doing in this moment in his life. So in Genesis chapter 39, we're going to add to the dot to dots that we've been putting forward. Last week we started talking about Joseph, and that this man Joseph had this ornamented robe, this beautiful robe. He was his father's favorite. The brothers didn't think too much of that. And we had a dot to dot happen if he's thrown into the cistern. So here's a brushstroke of his life. Then you end up, he's taken out of the cistern and he's sold to slave traders. The Ishmaelites buy him for 20 shekels, which was the price of a slave, and they take him off into slavery. Another brushstroke of his life, another dot to dot of his life. And now we're going to see where he goes from slavery, that he goes into Potiphar's house, and things are absolutely incredible. And we're going to see a lot of dot to dots come together today. Now, if you know the end of the story, which I know many of you do, act like you don't. Let's just watch the movie develop scene by scene. Let's see what happens because that will give us encouragement in our own lives because you don't know the end of the story for your own life. We've got to surrender the end of the story to the Lord. A complicated life, but a faithful God. We have complicated lives, but a faithful God. And if we don't guess the end of the story for Joseph, but if we'll see it come out, working out, it'll be able to encourage us as we see the story being worked out in our own lives as well. Look at Genesis chapter 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. That's the slave aspect. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Many commentators means that he was chief of the executions. bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph and he prospered. He lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that God was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything that he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and he became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household and he entrusted him to his care everything that he owned. Verse 5, and from that time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, and the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. Nothing better than the hand of God in your life. The blessing of the Lord was on everything that Potiphar had, both in his house and in the field. He left Joseph in charge, in care of everything that he had. Tremendous delegation. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Doesn't that sound like a man, ladies? All he cares about is his meal. What's he going to get? Didn't concern himself with anything but the food that he ate. Now, Joseph was well-built and handsome. Scene one, things are great. Things are great. Joseph has gone from being the favorite son of his dad. That's a good thing. His brothers beat him up. That's not a good thing. Thrown into the cistern. His ornament robe has been taken away from him. This gift that his father had given him. It symbolized he was in charge and he was the favorite. He's thrown into the cistern, the well. He's sold to slaves. Things are bad. The slave traders take him. He is sold. And now he's in Potiphar's house. He's in charge of everything that he could have at his disposal. But he does not have the responsibility of being the owner of it. Better to have a friend with a boat than to own the boat yourself, right? So he's got all that Potiphar has, but he doesn't have the responsibility that Potiphar has. And so he's got everything in scene one. Everything is good. Scene one, stay faithful in good times. Stay faithful in good times. Galatians 6 verse 9 says, let us not become weary in doing good. For in the proper time we will reap a harvest if we are faithful. Stay faithful in good times. It is so crazy, it's so weird, but we have a tendency to drift from the Lord when things are good. When everything's great financially, well, we just start doing and doing and doing and doing, and giving actually decreases. When things get tough in our lives financially, we're pleading for the Lord. Please, God, please, God, please, God. We're looking at every decision. Is this going to glorify God or not glorify God? We're giving to God. We're doing all the things. When things are going good, we have a tendency to drift. When things are good in our marriage, we don't keep up with it as much as we should. When things are good at our office, we don't work quite as hard as we should. When things are good in life, we kind of just take a little bit of a back seat. But when things are bad, we're clawing and trying and going and making it happen. Isn't it odd that all throughout the Old Testament, when things are going great, people drift away from the Lord? When things are going bad, and then they start coming back to the Lord. It's a very interesting, interesting thing. Here he stays faithful. Here, while things are going good, Joseph is trusted. Joseph is at the top of the world. God is with him. He's a long way from the cistern. He's a long way from being sold in slavery. He's enjoying the good times and remaining faithful. Can I tell you that sometimes as believers, we have trouble enjoying the good times. We're so afraid that if we enjoy the good that's happening in our life, it's going to spin into pride. If we enjoy the good that's happening in our life, it's going to spin into materialism. If we enjoy the good that's happening into our life, it's just going to spin into some kind of weird Christian guilt. And so we always kind of take a false humility. Oh, yeah, things are going good. We know it's going good. We're excited about it going good. But, well, you know, but this is happening, that's happening. And we just don't ever enjoy the things going good. Let me just tell you something. Enjoy it when it's going good, because it's not going to always last. Not everything is always going to be going good. Business is not always going to be going good, and it's not always going to be going bad. Relationships are not always going good, and they're not always going to be going bad. Things go good, things go bad, and so it goes with the dot to dot to dot to dot of life. Every brushstroke that's a black hue of dark color and sadness, every brushstroke that's a yellow and a bright hue of happiness, they all come together to put the dot to dot meaning of our life. And so stay faithful in the good times. When it's good, enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, you will find that if you enjoy it maturely, it will bring gratitude in your heart before the Lord. And gratitude before God is a great, great thing. It builds you up. It strengthens you. It says in Romans 1 that all this litany of sin comes at the end of Romans 1 because they did not glorify God and they aren't grateful in their hearts before him. Lack of gratitude is the beginning of sin. But gratitude over good things that God has blessed you with is the beginning of growth. We got away with our family, and not just our family, but kind of extended family. It was 14 of us, 9 adults, 5 kids, the cousins, the whole deal. We went to Gulf Shores, Alabama. We were there before the oil type of thing happened, so that was good. So we were grateful for that. And we had one night where we had dinner, and we decided we were going to order pizza. And we ordered pizza, had it delivered to the condo, and then walked down to the beach. So we spent like $100 in pizza to feed everybody. We walked down to the beach, and we'd forgotten paper plates. We just take the pizza boxes, we rip them up. So now everybody's got a little square of ripped up cardboard for their paper plate. And we put the pizza on it, and we're sitting there with some paper towels. We had Cokes and water, and the kids are playing, and we're eating pizza. And I was sitting there, and I just, as the sun was setting, I thought, this is good. This is really good. We just got pizza on a piece of cardboard, family. Later on that night, we had planned a big endeavor. We were going sand crab hunting with flashlights. And we walked down the beach that night, and we got back, and I just thought, this is so good. And I enjoyed it and enjoyed it and enjoyed it. And you know what? Out of those 14, not everybody's going to be healthy forever. Not everybody's going to have things going on great forever. Things were good, and I was grateful. It didn't go into pride, and it didn't go into materialism, and it didn't go into guilt. And it went into gratitude to God. And here Joseph is, and things are good. But it's not going to stay like that, unfortunately. The next dot of his life, of scene two, comes in verse 13. It says this in verse 13. Verse 7. In 13 is where we're ending. Verse 7. Let's read the end of verse 6 too, though. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. Remember that in just a moment. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has not withheld anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this, such a thing, such a wicked thing, and underline this, and sin against God? Not against Potiphar, not against his wife, not against his family, sin against God. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Underline, or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Underline, ran out of the house. Things are great. He's got everything in his fingertips. He's in charge. Did you see at the end of verse 6? It says he is well built and handsome. Ladies, that means he looks like your husband. He's chiseled. He's handsome. He's well built and he's handsome. If that's not your husband, it is now. Your husband is well built and handsome to you. That's where we're going with this story. And so in this moment, things are great. And then scene two, temptation seeks our downfall daily. Temptation seeks our downfall daily. One person put it like this, opportunity comes around once, opportunity knocks once in a lifetime, but temptation bangs on the door for years. Opportunity may knock every once in a while, but temptation bangs on the door for years. The daily proposition of temptation wears us out. And then finally, it escalates. It escalates. All around our culture, we are saturated by sexual temptation. Billboards on the roads, sex sells. TV, it's all over the place. Internet, be very careful. It has saturated our culture, and so we have a breakdown of our culture because you can't build a culture on extreme liberal, not political, but moral. Liberal individual agendas cannot build a society. It has to be a moral family base that builds a society. That's how societies are built. But when you destroy the family and you end up with all these individual amoral, immoral aspects, society breaks down. And so here in this moment, there's daily temptation that we encounter over and over and over again. It bangs on the door of our lives. Potiphar's wife daily came after him, this strong, handsome man. There's a tradition, not from the Bible, but just from history, that Potiphar's wife had a party for the 40 prettiest, most beautiful ladies in Egypt. Sound like a click? Does to me. 40 of the most beautiful ladies all come over to her house. So she's probably an attractive lady herself. And when Joseph walked into the room, they screamed out, "He's an angel, not a man." So here's this moment where this sexual temptation is happening with this beautiful woman to this beautiful man. It's tempting him daily, daily, daily. Oral Hershiser was a pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And they asked him, they said, "Oral Hershiser, how do you strike somebody out?" He said, "This is what you do. With two strikes, you throw them the exact pitch they want, just a little bit outside, just a little bit low, just a little bit inside, just a little bit high. If they want a curveball, you give them a curveball. They want a fastball, you give them a fastball. They want a sinker, you give them a sinker. You just give it a bit out of the strike zone." And so it is with the temptations that Satan puts before us. It's exactly what our flesh wants, just a bit outside. And here, we've got to come to realize that Joseph, he keeps on going. He says, "No, no, no, I'm not even going to be with her. I'm not even going to be around her." And he realizes that this is a sin against God. Do you know that sexual sin, all sin, it's a sin against God? It's not a sin just against somebody else, and though it can be. Not a sin just against yourself, though it can be. It is a sin first and foremost to God. So our society has removed God, so there is no accountability, so there is no sin. And so what used to be sinful, listen, what used to be sinful is now accessible and acceptable in our society. What used to be sinful, you'd have to go way back in the back to go and get some smutty magazines way in the back. Now you could just go to your computer. Now you could just turn on your TV. It used to be sinful. Now it's accessible. It used to be sinful, and now it's acceptable. No problem with it. No problem. This is my own decisions, because we are top of the food chain. We make our own decisions. And it says here that this sin, first and foremost, was a sin against God. And that's where we grieve in our hearts, when we realize that human beings have a tendency to run from God and to miss what he wants to do. To sin against God. But he takes it and he moves out in a way that is amazing. He runs. Three things on protecting us from this. Number one, know whose you are. Know whose you are. It says, if we look back in this little section of scripture in verse 8 and 9, he says, "He refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care, except for you." He knows that he belongs to his master. He knows whose he is. Do you know whose you are? That if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you belong to Jesus Christ. The Holy Spirit lives inside your heart. You are a new creation in a new covenant, in a new relationship with God. You don't want sin. You want holiness. Sin is chocolate-covered dog food. And you don't eat dog food because you're not a dog. Doesn't matter what it's covered with. And Christians don't want in their heart sin because they're no longer sinners. They're now saints. Doesn't mean we do everything perfect, but that Jesus Christ lives inside of us. He's taken us from darkness to light, from broad road to narrow road, from destruction to life. And so now we say, "Lord, my greatest desire is not for sin, it's for holiness. And I know whose I am. I belong to God. I belong to God." Number two, protect yourself. Protect yourself. Did you see what he did? It said at the end of that verse, of verse 10, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. He protected himself. He protected himself. Because in protecting himself, he ends up where he is going forward in the right direction, not in the wrong direction. Protecting himself. He's not even going to be with her. We have to protect what we see. We have to protect what we hear. Average teenager students, average teenager watches 3 to 4 hours a day of television. And 83% of the programming that you're watching contains sexual content. MTV, on average, has 9 sexual scenes per hour, 18 sexual depictions per hour, 17 instances of sexual dialogue or innuendo, compared to only 5.8 after 10 o'clock, which is considered when only adults are watching on normal stations. We've got to protect ourselves. We've got to be aware of knowing what that is. Let me put it as simply as I can put it for the married folks in the room. You never need to be alone with anyone of the opposite gender. You don't need to be alone with anyone of the opposite gender. If you don't touch the rope, you'll never ring the bell. But what happens? Someone catches our eye. We begin to look forward to seeing them. Next step, we begin to plan to see them. Next step, we begin to move away from the group to begin to see them individually. And pretty soon, Potiphar's wife and Joseph, did you notice? There's no servants in the house. Affairs don't happen in packs. They happen when individuals begin to meet as individuals. If you're eating with a lady, it better be your mama or your wife. If you're traveling with a lady, it better be your mama or your wife or your daughter. It might be that you got to have a hard conversation with your boss and say, you know what, I'm sorry, I just don't feel comfortable traveling like I've been traveling. I will be the hardest worker that you will ever have, but I can't go to that dinner like that anymore. And your wife will celebrate, and you will protect yourself. Job 31:1 says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. If you get in trouble, just dial 311. Job 31:1, I've made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully upon a woman. Proverbs 6, verse 23, these commandments are light. The teaching is a lamp to keep you on the correction, and these corrections are the path of discipline, to keep you on the way, to keep you from the path of the adulterous or immoral woman. We are never called to fight sexual temptation. We're always called to flee it. And fleeing is the off button on the remote control, the delete button on the computer, and the protecting of your life of how you operate and you go forward. Protect yourself. It's dangerous and it'll kill you. This past week, I was at the checkout stand, and you know, we've got all the candy. They always put the candy at the checkout stand. What seemed like at the checkout stand growing up as a kid, I know my mom probably bought me all the candy in the world, but it seemed like I never got as much candy at the checkout stand as I wanted. So I've tried as a dad kind of buy more candy at the checkout stand, you know, see something they're interested in. That's a fun little blessing. And so we've got this. And so here is this gummy, you know, gummy bears, a gummy snake, 3 feet long at the checkout stand. And I'm like, my dude's going to love that. That's going to be awesome. So I get the gummy snake. It's about a half dollar in diameter. It's 3 feet long, and it's only $3. So I'm like $1 a foot. That's perfect. That's great. So I grab this. So I'm holding this gummy snake. It looks kind of weird standing at the checkout stand holding a 3-foot snake in a wrapper. But I'm standing there, and so I buy the gummy snake, and I'm just like, I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to put this on Kelly's pillow tonight. It is going to be awesome. I'm going to freak her out. Then I start thinking, no, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to lay the snake down in the backyard, and I'm just thinking this whole thing up. I'm going to lay this snake down in the backyard, and I'm going to go up to the window with my son, my 8-year-old, and I'm going to say, look, Grayson, there's a snake in the backyard. Let's go get him. And then we're going to walk out in the backyard, and I'm going to grab the snake from behind the head. I'm going to lift it up. I'm going to wiggle it like it's a fight. Then I'm going to put it in my mouth, and I'm going to bite its head off. And I'm going to spit the head one way, and I'm going to throw the tail the other way. And just in victory, just like, yeah! Man of the manor. So I get this, and I'm just thinking this through. And you know how when you've been thinking about something a long time, but then the people you're about to talk to, they hadn't been thinking about this at all. So I come in. I say, Kelly, I got this snake. It's on. She's like, what is that? I'm like, it's going to be great. Send Grayson up to his room first. Tell him to go do something. What I'm going to do is I'm going to grab it. I'm going to wiggle it. I'm going to stick it in my, I'm going to bite its head off. It's going to be great. She's like, okay, really? Okay. So he goes up to do a little chore in his room. I go and I lay it perfectly in the grass right by the window. And so he comes down and I start kind of walking over to the window. And Grayson, there's a snake out there. And it's white with like neon blue and black. You know, it's candy, but it's white, blue, and black. And so we come out and he grabs this little Astro bat. You know, you get at the ballpark for like $6. He grabs it and he's like. So I'm walking up and I go, Grayson, look, it's a white back. I don't know. It is? Yeah. I don't know what a whiteback is, but it sounded good. So we walk up, and he's got his bat, and he's just got like this, I'm getting that snake. So I go, okay, I'm going to grab it. He's like, you sure, you sure? I said, yeah, I'm going to grab it. So I pick it up. Whoa, I start fighting with it like this. I put it in my mouth, rip the head off. Pull, foom, 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 whoa, foom, shoom, shoom. And then Gracie goes, Daddy. Isn't that kind of an overreaction? I mean, did you have to bite the head off? Wouldn't a hoe work? I mean, something? And then at that moment, you know, as I'm kind of thinking, this was awesome, I look and my little two-year-old girl, she's just out there in just diapers, okay? I mean, you know, that's she had stained all her clothes with eating stuff. And so she's just out there with diapers, sucking her thumb in panic. She goes running back in the house to mom. So we're trying to convince her. No, it's candy. So we're bringing her the snake. It's candy. I mean, just crazed. So now I got to have counseling for my two-year-old. My eight-year-old thinks it's cool. You know, we planned out to get all our neighbors later on with this, you know, little trick. And so the baby goes back in. Our two-year-old goes back in. And I'm telling you, that was Thursday afternoon. Every day, at least four times a day, the two-year-olds come up to me and said, Daddy, snake backyard. And I said, yeah, snake in the backyard. She goes, Daddy, eat snake head. Daddy, eat snake head. So I've tried to spin it. Daddy's protecting you. And I did it, you know, because the candy thing, it didn't work. But here we have this crazy story with a candy snake. But I want you to hear this. A relationship, sexual temptation, that snake's real. And if you get close to it, it's going to get you. And you've got to protect yourself. And some of us have taken our lusts and we've grabbed them and we're holding them thinking they're sweet. And they're deadly. Deadly to your relationship with God. Not that you're not saved, that's not what I mean, but in the intimacy with God. Deadly in your marriage. Deadly in your own life. Run. Run. That's what Joseph does. He runs. We're not called to fight it. We're called to flee it. And when you run, it is far better to be thought rude than interested. Far better to be thought rude than interested. Choose being rude than being interested. You and I must flee and run from it. Now, it's interesting when you look at this because a lot of times we think messages like this are just for men because men struggle with lust and women don't. That's not true. This is for both genders. Now, it is true that sexually men respond first physically and then second emotionally. Women respond first emotionally and then second physically. Doesn't mean women aren't physical. Doesn't mean men aren't emotional. It just means first men are physical, then emotional, then first women are emotional, and then physical. That's why lustful literature for men has no words and lustful literature for women has no pictures. Because we respond differently and God's rigged it to put it together in the confines of marriage so that it goes together where there's safety emotionally and there's safety physically and then it makes sense to be able to come together like that. But in this, let's think about Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife, we throw out oftentimes, is just she's the perpetrator, she's the cougar. Well, let's just throw her out. And throw that out and let that be a moment where we just go, well, who cares about her? Here's the deal, though, that she's also a human being. What's her issue? Her issue, as Beth Moore puts it in the Patriarch Study, that she is a bored woman, a bored wife of a busy man. A bored wife of a busy man. He's running Egypt. He doesn't have time for the home. He's got somebody delegated to run the home. Oh, men, can we hear it? Hear it and take it to heart. A bored woman of a busy man is a bad equation. Ladies, where do you go mentally when you're bored? Ladies, where do you go mentally when you're lonely? And where you go mentally when you're bored and when you're lonely will identify for you your tendencies towards sin and will tendencies towards some things that might just get you in trouble. Each of us must run. Ladies running to the Lord with loneliness. Ladies running to the Lord with boredom. Men running to the Lord with physical and emotional. Ladies with emotional and physical and taking it to God and running from these situations. You will grab that snake and you will lose. It is not sweet. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 23, he who commits adultery with a woman is stupid and wishes to destroy himself. Flee. Know whose you are. Protect yourself and run. Puritan preacher put it like this: Joseph lost his coat, but he kept his character. Joseph lost his coat, but he kept his character. Do you see another dot? Do you see another brushstroke of who this man is? He's lost two coats now, but he's still walking with God. Scene three, let's look at it in verse 13. Joseph hasn't done anything wrong, but verse 13. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, good for you, Joseph, she called her household servants and said, look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him the story that the Hebrew slave you brought to us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left the cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story that his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me, he burned with anger. And Joseph's master, remember, he could have been the head of the executions. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison. Grace, really, mercy, could have killed him. The place where the king's prisoners were confined. Now, the king's prisoners were confined in a different prison. These were political prisoners, not criminal prisoners. So another place of grace that he gives him, and he puts him with the political prisoners, not with the criminal prisoners. Look at what happens at the end of verse 20. But while Joseph was there in prison, doesn't this sound familiar from the beginning of the chapter? The Lord was with him and showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all that he held in the prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. And the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Verse 20 and 21 are just the same as verse 2 and verse 3. Here's scene 3. Prisons don't remove his presence. Prisons don't remove God's presence. Joseph was on top of the world in Potiphar's house. Now he's in the prison, and do you know what? Genesis 40, verse 3 tells us that the prison is in Potiphar's house. It's in the same place. So he's in the place where he was in the penthouse, and now he's in the prison. And God's presence is still with him. God's presence does not matter how much money you make or how much money you lose. God's presence does not matter whether you are falsely accused or suffering in innocence, or everyone says what is true. Potiphar's wife comes to this handsome man, built strong. Same words that were describing his mother, Rachel, in Genesis chapter 29, verse 17, that she was beautiful of form. Same words. And she says, I want this man. People that think the Bible is a bunch of angels sitting on clouds playing harps, you don't read your Bible. Some sultry stuff in this deal. She says, I want him. He says, no. He runs and he pays the price and he's now in prison, but he has his character intact. He knew whose he was and he trusted God. Where can you go from God's presence? For nothing can separate us from Christ Jesus. So let's look at this whole thing and this dot to dot. And then one more illustration and we're done. Brushstrokes of Joseph's life. Sold into slavery because his brothers got mad and stole his garment. Thrown into the cistern, sold into slavery. Everything's great. Dot to dot to dot to dot. It looks good. Potiphar's wife, he's even a handsome man. She wants him. Not so good. He gets falsely accused even though he's doing the right thing. Dot to dot. Pull out the brush that has the black and dark and grays. And now he's back in prison. Or he's in prison for the first time to be able to see the dot to dot of his life. It's not a candy snake. It's not a strike. It is an out and it is poison. I close with this illustration. Niagara Falls, a man named Dr. George Sweeting told a story about his family going on a trip to Niagara Falls, and it was a time in the spring, and so the ice blocks were rolling down the river as the winter was melting off. What had happened is some of the fish had gotten frozen into the ice upstream, and so there was blocks of ice that had fish carcasses, a dead fish that was in a block of ice. And so the vultures and the ravens would come down, and they would get in that block of ice, and they would claw into it. They'd ride it down the river, chipping away at it with its beak to finally break the ice enough to now they're eating the fish. And so they would put their claws in it, and then right before the falls, they'd let go of the ice, and they'd fly away, and they'd let the dead fish go over the ice, and they would eat what they wanted to eat from it. And they're watching this happen, and these ice blocks would come down, and the birds would fly off. The ice blocks would come down, and the birds would fly off. Ice blocks would come down, and then they started watching this one, and he kept getting closer and closer and closer, and he had his claws in the ice, and what had happened is his claws had gotten into the ice, and they had gotten stuck. So now he's feasting upon this fish, and it's getting closer and closer, and he's trying to flap his wings to pull out, and he can't, and he's getting pulled, and the ice pulls off to the, goes off the edge. His wings flap up. He goes up for just a second and then gets yanked down the falls and dies. So it is with sin. Oh, we're feasting on something we think is sweet as candy, and now our claws are stuck. Who shall set us free but Jesus? And if Jesus doesn't set your claws free, you're going over the falls. And that bird couldn't fly and lift it out. It was too late. And sexual sin, hear me, students, because all of culture has got crosshairs on you, will destroy your life. Run. Better to be thought rude. Run. You'll pay a price you don't want to pay. If you don't know Jesus Christ as Savior, run to the cross. If you do, and this is a part of your life, run to the cross. If you want to join the church, obviously every decision that is made today doesn't have to do with what we're talking about in this message. You're free to come and join the church, to be baptized, to pray. But as God speaks, let's live with a healthy fear.
Thank you for listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church. We invite you to worship with us anytime you're near. We're located at the corner of I-10 West and the 610 Loop. Visit us online at houstonsfirst.org.